Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I am Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. And I'm happy to say that joining me once again today is Laith Maarouf. Laith is an award-winning journalist and political commentator who has worked in media, or as he aptly puts it, worked to decolonize media since 1999. He regularly appears on TV and radio, including on Radio Sputnik, on the show The Critical Hour on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. He's frequently on Press TV, as well as Al Mayadeen. He has published with various independent media outlets, including Electronic Intifada, Mint Press, and others. And as I said, I'm pleased to have him back with me today. So without further ado, Laith, welcome. How are you?
Thank you very much for having me. I'm doing good. I hope everything's good. Where are you at?
Yes, things are fine, all things considered. So as I understand it, you are currently in Beirut, is that correct?
Yes, I landed yesterday here.
Okay, so I think then I would like to start with the parliamentary elections that recently went down in Lebanon on Sunday. And I've been trying to follow the results from where I am in the States, and it's been hard, if not impossible, to get any information on the results in Western corporate media. They're all but ignoring the elections. But if I go to Arab news sources, I can find some information about the results. So it seems that Hezbollah did retain a number of its seats, but that it lost some seats. So I'm just wondering if you can speak to that, as well as the resistance parties in total, how their results have borne out so far.
Yeah, well, definitely the Western media has been really vague in their coverage of the elections. And the weirdest thing is obviously seeing all these headlines talking about Hezbollah losing the elections because it is, illogical and doesn't actually cover. But it's similar to the headlines that we saw about Ukraine right now with the surrender of the neo-Nazis in Mariupol being called a evacuation. So just to be more clear about the results of the elections, obviously some of your listeners may know that the system in Lebanon, electoral system, has been installed by the French, and it is a sectarian system where you have to, a person has to vote for the supposed sect that they belong to. So if you are an Orthodox Christian, you can only vote for Orthodox Christian seats. If you're a Maronite Christian, you can only vote for Maronite Christian seats, and Sunnis, same, Shias, Alawites, and 18 different sects that are acknowledged by the Constitution. So it's a it is a very complex system where somebody like the members of parliament that got elected for Hezbollah's party, the parliamentary party of Hezbollah, they would have, let's say, a 50,000 votes over their next candidate that was running against them. But when you look at somebody who's belonging to the Christian supremacist parties that are aligned with the United States and Israel, they get elected on seats with just a few hundred votes difference to the next competitor. So ultimately, Hezbollah and its coalition garnered more than half of the actual votes of whoever cast their votes. But they still didn't receive 51% of the seats in the parliament because of the sectarian layout of things. So currently, Hezbollah didn't lose any seats that it ran for and actually won all the seats that it ran for. Similarly, for Amal, which is the other Shia party that is aligned with Hezbollah, and the third party that is considered part of the resistance coalition is that of the President Aoun. It is called the Patriotic Movement, and they are the Christian party, and they had lost some of their seats. If you noticed in the last year and so, during the build-up to this campaign, much of the attacks were on the Christian party led by President Aoun, because it is aligned with the resistance, and therefore that is where what happened. But there is no bloc right now that can get a majority of seats. Ultimately, Hezbollah didn't lose anything. It is, and neither did the imperialists gain really control of the parliament.
I see. Yes, in Western corporate media, if they report it at all, it's reported as Hezbollah losing somehow in a significant way. And as far as I can tell, based on what you've just laid out and based on what I've been able to find in Arab media, that's not the case. I'm looking at a breakdown right here on AlAhadNews.com, which is a Lebanese outlet, and it shows a map of Lebanon and the different voting districts. So, for example, in Bint Jabil, which is in the very south of Lebanon, Hassan Fadlallah got 43,324 votes. And if you look at the other candidates who retained their seats, the votes are in the tens of thousands. So from 10,000 all the way up to almost 50,000. Mohammed Raad, for example, had 48,543 votes, and he's in Nabaliya. So it seems like, based on what you've said and this information I've been able to find, that Hezbollah received a very considerable number of votes in their favor.
Yes, and actually they had an increase in number of voters that came out to them. So what I was trying to explain to you, that imagine if this was not a sectarian electoral system, Hezbollah and their allies would have taken every seat, because the fact that they garnered more than almost 60% of the votes, if you count them as in non-sectarian way. But ultimately, because of the sectarianism that is installed by the imperialists, it is impossible to govern a country like this. And even when Hezbollah was and its coalition had 51% of the seats in parliament in the last election in 2018, we saw how the United States and the Saudis and the Israelis did everything in their hand over the last 4 years available to them to make sure that Hezbollah and its coalition cannot govern. So basically, for the last 4 years, Lebanon was an ungovernable state. And right now, with this election, I don't think it's going to get any better.
Right. And this time around, there was absolutely interference from Israel and Saudi as well. I forget the exact name of the party that's essentially allied with Saudi, but Saudi was in there very hard trying to shore up some sort of victory for that party. What is the name of that party, by the way?
It's the Lebanese Forces Party, which is a Christian phalange, meaning a Christian supremacist party led by war criminal Samir Jaja, who spent years in jail here in Lebanon before being pardoned. But basically, this since the Saudis destroyed the future party, which was led by the Hariri dynasty, and representing the Sunnis, they put all their money behind the Christian supremacist party of the Lebanese forces. Now, the destruction of the future party meant that the Sunni population had no real party to represent them, and there was a lot of new names that came out or unaffiliated. And therefore, we have now a situation where even if the Americans or the Saudis think that by Hezbollah's coalition not having a clear majority in the parliament, that they will maybe try to control the country or disarm Hezbollah, as that's the aim of the United States and the Saudis and Israel, they will have to negotiate with individual independent politicians, new elected with egos. It's not like you can go negotiate with a head of a party and then all the votes of that party come with you. So it's going to be practically impossible for even the you know, the Americans and the imperialists in general to gain anything from this election.
Yes, and just referring back to this map I'm looking at, the candidates who won their respective seats, this is all across Lebanon. It's not concentrated in one particular region of the country. It's spread throughout, I suppose you could call them voting districts. So in Baalbek, for example, all the way down to Tyre, and then all the way back up to Beirut and Jabil. So it's throughout the entire country. It's not just concentrated in the south, for example. So I think that's important to note as well. And that speaks to, you know, the people's will, I would say.
Yes, yes, and I mean, this, they spent so much money on this electoral campaign, the United States and its vessels in the region. Billions of dollars were spent on these, you know, NGOs. There's in Lebanon close to 30,000 NGOs servicing this supposed 4 million population. It's an astronomical number of NGOs intervening on the streets of the country in the politics, and even this flood of money and all the bribes. It's the Electoral Commission was reporting today on the huge amount of bribes that were flooding the market to buy votes over the election. None of that was able to, you know, shake up the base of support for resistance in general, and all the sets, all the parts of society. So we could say that probably this was the most expensive electoral campaign outside the United States that the empire spent on. That was a total waste.
Yes, and what I wanted to add to that is that the Falange, which is represented by the Lebanese forces, they, of course, were the militia, as some call them, who were unleashed by the Zionist occupation entity into the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps, the Palestinian refugee camps, in September of 1982, and carried out the genocidal massacre there of thousands upon thousands of Palestinian refugees. So just to give some historical context to that. And I had a question that I'm hoping you could answer. It's more of a question of curiosity, but Hassan Fadlala, is he of any relation to the late Ayatollah Fadlala?
I'm not sure right here now, but obviously it's a very renowned family, the Fadlallah family, and he definitely would be gaining from this, you know, name, family name.
Yes. Okay. So we have to throw it to a quick break, but when we come back, I want to move to Palestine and talk about some recent happenings there. There's actually quite a lot to talk about. I think you'd agree. So more with Laith Maroof after this short break.
TNT Radio's Rick Munn.
Where it's almost like it's the devil's own award ceremony. You know, they're demons rewarding demons with prizes, you know. A hotter spot in hell for the best and most effective vaccine. You know, Pfizer got this and Moderna got that. That's what it is. You know, that's really what it is. If people could actually see what this is, if they had eyes to see, they would see what this is. It's not something that's beneficial to the world. And this business of this plan that you talked about as well, and I concur 100%, it's not a case of, okay, you get your two shots, we're done with you. No, this is going to be a constant, regular thing. Do not fall for the lie that was told 2 years ago. Like, you take your two shots, you've stepped up to the plate, you're a patriot, you'll be safe, you won't transmit, everyone can go back to normal. No, you need your first booster shot, you need your second booster shot, you're going to need an annual shot with a flu shot, your children are going to have to get these shots even though there's no risk to them.
Locked and Loaded with Rick Munn on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Election 2022, and Australia decides on the 21st of May.
The government keeps piling on more regulations that they are suffocating small business. Between 2013 and 2017, this Liberal government added over 100,000 pages of regulation. Hi, I'm John Ruddick, and I'm running for the Liberal Democrats as their Senate candidate in New South Wales. I want to talk about the sixth policy in the Liberal Democrats' Freedom Manifesto, a small business policy. Research shows that red tape costs the Australian economy $176 billion every year. Some regulation is essential, but most of the time it's pointless and it just feeds the bureaucracy. The Liberal Democrats want to cut red tape so small business can thrive. We will do this by implementing the following. One in, two out policy. Every one new regulation issued, at least two prior regulations must be identified for elimination. We need to remove retail trading hour restrictions. Businesses must be able to determine their own opening hours without government interference. Cut and decentralise the minimum wage. Australia currently has the highest minimum wage in the world. Larger businesses can afford to replace workers with machines or offshore, but small businesses just have to cope with less staff. We need to relax occupational licensing and certification. No more pointless PDF questions to get your cert for unskilled roles. We've got to learn on the job. We need to cut green tape. Environmental regulations are out of control and look set to worsen with the insane net zero emission targets. Technology and entrepreneurialism will do a far better job at protecting the planet than a bunch of politicians flying on their private jets to catastrophize climate alarmism conferences. We need a government that is pro-startups, not one that's always trying to sort of bully new entrepreneurs. We need to liberalise employment law. We'd make it easy and straightforward for small businesses to employ people under flexible agreements that work for employer and employee. One of the most heartbreaking outcomes of COVID hysteria is that it has smashed small business and strengthened the dominance of big business. Big business is big enough to look after itself. The Liberal Democrats' small business policy will see more people employed, more small businesses thriving, and entrepreneurs creating a better future for us all. Please check out our Freedom Manifesto.
To find out more, visit ldp.org.au.
Authorised by John Humphreys for the Liberal Democratic Party, Mount Waverley, Victoria.
Where progress is influenced by revolution and evolution. This is today's News Talk Radio.
TNT.
TNT.
Welcome back to Perspective. I am Jesse Zerwell, and I've been speaking with independent journalist and political analyst, geopolitical analyst, Laith Maroof. And we were speaking before the break about Lebanon's recent parliamentary elections, which took place last Sunday, this past Sunday on the 15th. And I want to shift to Palestine, Laith, but just one comment on the elections. You mentioned the investments, so to speak, that were made by the NGOs to try to buy these elections. And it's really sick to think about, not just in terms of trying to bribe their way to victory in these elections, but it's sick in the context of what Lebanon has been suffering economically. The fact that there is energy ready to be pumped in from Egypt via Syria, but both the US and the World Bank are blocking this. And there are no NGOs, no Western NGOs putting any money, as far as I can tell, toward trying to ameliorate the misery that the Lebanese people have been experiencing for years now, economically and otherwise. So it's very disgusting that these NGOs can try to launder money to get their preferred candidates elected, but they don't care about the Lebanese people in the end, and that's very obvious from the fact that no assistance has been provided to deal with the energy crisis, for example, the hyperinflation, the insane exchange rate. So I just wanted to make that comment, and if you have anything you'd like to add.
Yeah, definitely. Sure. You know, one thing I didn't mention is that is actually, you know, it doesn't matter how much votes you get, because the way the parliament is set up, and when the French left, they divvied up these seats to the sex according to the census in 1942, when at that time the Christian population was around half of the population. Now today, it's the Shia population, not even just the Sunnis, the Shias alone are half of the population. But because of how these seats are divvied up according to the census, and they're not doing, they haven't done a census since then, by the way, because they're too scared. If they reassign the seats according to the census, it will be a Hezbollah government without any even coalition with anybody else. And therefore, this is not a democratic state. There's no way for people to actually govern according to what the populace want.
Right. So, yeah, I would like to, you know, just from my point of view, from my vantage point here in the U.S., I would love to see that change, so that it actually represents how the voting constituencies actually are on the ground. But you know, that's for the Lebanese people to decide for themselves. I'm certainly not going to make any verbal impositions. You know, the French have done enough damage in that regard. So I want to move to Palestine, where since the last time we've talked, a lot has happened. We saw the murder, the assassination of the Al Jazeera journalist, Shireen Abu Akleh. And then we saw what happened at her funeral, which was just one of the most disgusting displays of inhumanity by the Zionist occupation entity. And, you know, that's saying a lot, because the disgusting displays of humanity they've put on are incalculable, the number. But we saw the pallbearers attacked and beaten. They almost dropped her casket. We saw the flag ripped off of her casket. And we saw the funeral party just mobbed by these Zionist occupation police. And it was you know, we know these occupation forces don't respect human life, but they also don't respect human life after they've taken it, obviously. And this speaks to what you and I talked about last time, which is these spasms of violence we're seeing from Western Empire, whether it's in Ukraine or whether it's in occupied Palestine. And this, to me, is certainly one of those spasms of violence, and perhaps unprecedented, but also the response to it by the people, by the Palestinian people, their resistance to it, I think, has been quite unprecedented. During her funeral, after this insane attack happened, there was a ringing of bells and a sort of cross-sectarian celebration of her life, which is something that's never quite happened before in occupied Palestine. But I read just yesterday that Israel arrested one of the pallbearers that was beaten at her funeral. So I'd like to get your take on this, because it's just disgusting, you know, what is coming from the Zionist occupation entity with complete silence from the West. And this comes on top of Israel, quote unquote, announcing that it's going to add nearly 4,000 new additions to its illegal colonies in the West Bank. So I'd just like to get your perspective on all of that, if possible.
Well, Shirin Abu Akhdi has been reporting on the ground from Palestine for almost three decades. She was one of the earliest faces that people in the region knew from Al Jazeera Arabic broadcasts from Palestine 27, 28 years ago when she started there. And so much of the population of the Arabic world recall their memories over the Second Intifada and all the, what happened through her broadcast, through her research, through her documentaries. And, you know, throughout this time, nobody ever asked or nobody, she never indicated, but she is a Palestinian Christian. And so when she was assassinated, you know, we saw a huge uproar from the Palestinian population. And, you know, people in Jenin, where she was assassinated, immediately, you know, coming out, you know, the 30,000 somewhat population of the refugee camp and added to it the population of the city itself, all were out in the street, like 50, 60,000 people marching with her body to the church in Jenin, and then from there to the church in Nablus, and then from there to the church in Beit Lahem, and then to Ramallah, where she had a national funeral with full honors. And of course, in every one of those cities, the masses of Palestinians were accompanying the casket and to the church. And as you mentioned, eventually when it reached Jerusalem, because that's where she's from, the Zionists were freaking out. And they attacked the French hospital run by the Orthodox Christian Church before even the casket came out. There was a press conference held by the hospital and the church two or three days ago that I watched. They detailed the videos of how the troops attacked and entered through tear gas inside the hospital before any of the pallbearers came out. And as you mentioned, one of the pallbearers that were attacked, the bravest one that everybody saw in the video, holding on to the casket, getting hit in the head and never let go. The Zionists are so malicious, so vicious, that they went and searched for him right now and arrested him yesterday. And just a few hours ago, the Zionists announced that they will not be conducting any investigation because as they see it, there was no wrongdoing done. Also, a few hours ago, there was video evidence released of the actual Zionist sniper shooting Shirin Abu Akleh. So anyone that had any doubt in their mind and or entertained that Zionists would be less malicious than this should now never ever doubt whenever the Palestinian people you know, point out two crimes that the Zionists have committed. Look, the way they have treated her in her life and in her death, and that the way that the Palestinian people responded to her sacrifice that she gave to, it's unprecedented, number one, in terms of the communal, cross-sectarian, you know, commemoration. And in terms of the numbers of people that came out in the streets in Palestine, other than for a military leader like, or a political leader like Yasser Arafat at his death, this has been unprecedented, and she will be remembered as a martyr of the free speech and a martyr of Palestine.
Yes, yes, and very, very rightly so. And I just want to add historical context that the Jenin refugee camp in 2002 was subject to a massacre by the Zionist occupation forces. One of the victims was an elderly man who was wheelchair bound and had a white flag attached to his wheelchair, and he was run over by a Zionist occupation entity tank. And then the UN, which was then headed by Kofi Annan, was about to lead an investigation into the massacre and then back down after the Zionists pressured him not to investigate. So there's Jenin has quite a history of atrocious genocidal attacks by the Zionist occupation entity. So
two things, yes, I would build on this comment that you just said. One is that Shirin Abu Akleh was the one that covered the invasion of the Jenin refugee camp live on air in 2002. And she had built a huge, very important relation with all the victims and their families. They remember her in person. And therefore, it was a targeted killing. It was a liquidation, an assassination, an extrajudicial execution of her because of her relationship to that refugee camp. And the other thing that about Kofi Annan, not only Kofi Annan was put under pressure like this for the Jenin refugee camp massacre, just before him in 1996, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, Boutros-Ghali, the first and only Arab Secretary General of the United Nations, he condemned the massacre in Qana, Lebanon, when the Israelis attacked the UN compound. Where the refugee people were hiding and came down, and that caused it, made the United States was so pissed at Boutros-Ghali that they did not allow for his renewal of his term, and he became the only UN Secretary General that didn't serve two terms, served only one term because he dared condemn another Israeli massacre.
Wow, I did not know that. And that massacre in 1996 killed more than 100 civilians, as well as UN workers, primarily Fijian UN workers. And then again in 2006, during Israel's war on Lebanon, in which they were defeated by Hezbollah, they carried out another massacre in Qana, not at the same compound, but still another massacre of civilians in Qana, which just speaks to the long history going all the way back to pretty much the origins of Zionism, of how this is a settler colonial ideology that has weaponized religion to fully eradicate other people, to steal their land, steal their resources. And it really has, these people really don't care about the religious aspect of what they claim Zionism is about. It's about stealing land and resources and building sort of a garrison empire in West Asia. You know, and I think there are the colonists, you know, the brats who come from New York and settle in Maale Adumim, for example, or Ariel, or Gush Katif when it still existed in Gaza. But these colonists actually believe what Zionism has laid out, but they are used by the state. And I have no sympathy for these colonists. I think they're wicked, but they are used by the state. Their zealotry is used. It's weaponized by the state for the state's ends, which is to completely eradicate the Palestinian people and completely take over their land. And that's why I get so chafed when I still hear talk about the two-state solution. I mean, I don't even understand why that's still in people's lexicon if they're serious about analyzing and understanding what's happening in Palestine. I mean, there's no chance in hell that that's ever going to happen because of the way the occupied West Bank has been carved up. But I just wanted to add that because, you know, none of this is really about religion or biblical conflict as it's so often framed. You know, it's simple. It's a settler colonial project, a European settler colonial project that is seeking to eradicate indigenous Palestinians from their land. That's what it boils down to.
You know, there's nothing, there's no invention, there's no originality in Zionism. It actually is a copy-paste from what the colonists said when they arrived in North America. They said when they arrived in North America that they found the promised land, that they are the chosen people, and they found heaven on earth. They said that they got a religious fatwa from the Pope, a religious decree calling the Americas terra nullius, a land without a people, for a people without a land. They also, the pilgrims came to the U.S. saying they're being persecuted for their religion, like the Holocaust, and therefore they need to kill indigenous people and take their land to save themselves. It's similar, copy-paste. There's nothing different. There's nothing original in Zionism, and it has nothing to do with Judaism.
Absolutely. So we need to throw it to another short break, but there is a bunch more I'd like to get your take on when we come back. So more with Laith Maroof after this.
Election 2022, and Australia decides on Saturday, May 21st. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
If there is one issue in this election which should be the central feature, it should be the federal government's response to COVID and how the nation can avoid such a disastrous and tragic response in future. But the major parties are intent on pushing the false narrative and play the tune of their big business financial sponsors, which include big pharma companies profiting at Australia's expense. A few days ago we saw, disgustingly I might add, Labor leader Anthony Albanese dodged a simple question on vaccine mandates from a member of the public. When are you going to put our workers back to work without mandates? A woman asked. And all Albanese said was, be polite, and scurried away. And Prime Minister Scott Morrison is keen to sign away Australia's sovereignty in healthcare to our WHO treaty. We can do much better. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
Mama, what does the chicken say? Dog. Cat. Giraffe.
Giraffe, really? Giraffe.
You're not going to get it all right. Just make sure you nail the big stuff, like making sure your kids are buckled correctly in the right seat for their age and size. Get it right.
Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg bought the 2020 election with hundreds of millions of dollars in funding that likely handed the White House to Joe Biden last year, according to a new analysis. Researcher William Doyle of the Caesar Rodney Election Research Institute, CRERI, said election funding funneled by Zuckerberg and his wife through two nonprofits significantly increased Joe Biden's vote margin in key swing states. The Center for Technology and Civic Life, CTCL, and the Center for Election Innovation and Research, CEIR, passed a staggering $419.5 million of Zuckerberg's money into local government elections offices. The research found the massive influx of funds essentially created a high-powered concierge-like get-out-the-vote effort for Biden that took place inside the election system, rather than attempting to influence it from the outside, appears to have generated enough additional votes for Biden to secure Electoral College victory in 2020.
This is TNT Radio, where you meet the entire menagerie of mankind and some who haven't yet been cataloged. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to Perspective. I am Jesse Zerwell, your host for the rest of the hour, and I've been speaking with Laith Maroof. And Laith, before we move to some recent developments in Syria, I just want to add on to our conversation before the break about Palestine, that as if it weren't bad enough, Shireen's assassination and then the desecration of her funeral on Nakba Day, Al-Aqsa was attacked yet again by the Zionists. And in addition to that, there has been a, I suppose what you could call a supremacist Zionist group, although that seems a bit redundant, that recently called for the destruction of Al-Aqsa. I'm sure you're aware of this, but
yes,
you know, again, this spasm of violence, it's never ending, and it's accelerating with each move that the Zionists make. So I don't know if you'd like to make a comment on that, but if you do, please do.
Yes, definitely. Look, as we see, you know, the Zionists and the imperialists in general, their options of tactical maneuvers in order to reach their strategic goals of supremacy, of domination, are dwindling. And these options that are in front of them are all, that are left in front of them are all suicidal and genocidal at the same time, you know. So Every time the Zionists don't assert themselves more, they are becoming weak. But every time they go and assert themselves harshly, they also lose. So ultimately, whatever they're doing is, whether they do nothing or do something, they are accelerating their decline. And this is true for the United States. And we will see this. There will be multiple things that happen, like this assassination of Shireen or the attack of the mosque and the, you know, starting the project to destroy the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And these are all crazy talk, but It look crazy, but actually these are the only options left to them.
Yes, I agree. So having said that, I want to move to Syria, where yesterday it was announced, and I'm reading here from thecradle.co, this headline: Pentagon clears troops, and these are U.S. troops, of responsibility for dropping 500-pound bomb on Syrian civilians in 2019. And then the subheader here is, last year, the New York Times revealed that a shadowy U.S. Army cell operating with no accountability was responsible for dropping over 100,000 bombs across Syria. So in this particular March 2019 airstrike in Deir ez-Zor in Syria, about 60 civilians were killed, but the Pentagon announced that it was, quote, not a violation of the military's rules of engagement, unquote. And I'll just add that not only was a 500-pound bomb dropped, but essentially a double tap happened where the U.S. came back around and dropped two more bombs, each one 2,000 pounds, on the same group of civilians who were obliterated. If you look at photos from the scene, I mean, it's a wasteland. And then to add to this, the U.S. is continuing to steal Syrian oil and transport it through its rat line over an illegal crossing into northern Iraq. And almost certainly this stolen oil is being sold on the international market to the highest bidder. It's not coming to the U.S. because the U.S. is desperate for collateral.
We actually know where this oil is going. It is all okay. going to Israel.
All of really?
It. All of it okay. is going through from North Iraq into the Jihan port in Turkey and then into the Zionist colony. It's in contract signed by the SDF, quote unquote, the Syrian Democratic Forces, i.e., the Kurdish contras. It's the contract is public, so we know what. Not only that, Syria, by the way, is one of the largest wheat producers in the world before the war on Syria. So right now, all the wheat of Syria is also being smuggled. We hear about wheat shortages in the world. Imagine what's the wheat shortage in Syria. One of the biggest producers of wheat in the world not being able to access its own, and that being smuggled, and we don't know where it's going. This attack on this pronouncement by the American army that there was no fault here in this massacre. Just today and yesterday, there's been constant attacks on multiple villages. I want to make it clear that my Syrian half, my father's side, is from Deir ez-Zor. This is my hometown, my home province in Syria. And I to see these small villages being attacked, every day these villagers are braving the situation and standing in front of the American troops as they try to cross their villages. They're blocking them. They're blocking the Kurdish contras, and they get attacked day in, day out. There's massacres in the villages of Deir ez-Zor and Hasaka. And so, this continues on. Yesterday, by the way, the French courts are now charging Lafarge cement manufacturer, which is one of the biggest cement manufacturers in the world, because during its the ISIS occupation of the northeast of Syria, of Raqqa, there is the largest cement factory in all of West Asia in there. And Lafarge continued this business, giving its money to paying taxes to ISIS, millions and millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars. And so we know that the resources and the of Syria will continue to be looted by America, and we know also the resistance will continue in Syria, and it's increasing. A few days ago, there was a massive attack on an American occupation base in northeast Syria. The week before, similar. So this is just going to increase in intensity.
Yes. I was just struck, though, by the depravity of this act. Of course, I was made aware of it last year when the New York Times reported on it. But the response, particularly by the Pentagon's press secretary, John Kirby, is just so inhuman. He said, quote, "We're admitting that, yes, we killed some innocent civilians, women and children in 2019 in Baghouz, Syria. It's all out there for you to see. We're admitting that we made those mistakes, that our operations ended up in the killing of innocent people." But he goes on, "It was necessary, it was quote unquote necessary in order to defeat 16 armed ISIS fighters." The report summary that came out from the Pentagon about this said that the U.S. commander involved, quote, "acted reasonably and within the bounds," unquote, "of international law," and, quote, "demonstrated awareness and concern for civilian casualties and took steps to mitigate harm," unquote. This is all just flagrant.
I don't know
lies.
How international law, how international law works with occupation that has not been authorized by the United Nations. Obviously,
exactly.
everything everything that the United States is doing in Syria is a war crime. Even just the presence of one American soldier on the soil of Syria without killing anybody is a war crime itself. Therefore, mm-hmm. you know, from that point on, anything and everything the United States does is a war crime.
Right. Right. And the same is true about the Zionist occupation entity. You know, it's, I've seen reports about Shireen's funeral, particularly in East Jerusalem, when it got to East Jerusalem, and there's no mention that it's occupied East Jerusalem. And so that totally strips away the context, the fact that those police, those so-called police, Zionist police who are attacking the funeral procession, they have no right to be there. It's not as if they're responding, you know, that they have a mandate to respond to civil disturbance or whatever. They have no right to be there. They have no right to be at any of the checkpoints they have set up throughout the occupied West Bank. So, you know, everything they do stemming from that first principle is de facto illegal. And as you just said, the same here applies to Syria. And this is, with regard to Syria, I see it as desperation on the part of Western Empire, particularly the U.S., because if we look at the U.S. economically, you know, the Fed has been buying up assets for the past several years to print new money and inject insane amounts of it into the U.S. market. And now the Fed owns somewhere around $9 trillion worth of assets, but it has no collateral to back up these assets. So it has, so oil, for example, would be collateral to back up these assets. And that's why it's carrying out piracy like this in Syria.
Exactly, exactly. The economy of the United States actually collapsed in 2008. And the mm-hmm. looting of resources of Libya that is ongoing, nobody knows where its resources are gone. The looting of resources of Syria, of Yemen, propped up the empire for the last 12 years. And now that is not even enough to continue the prop up. And we see the collapse accelerating because they can't loot other countries. They tried with Venezuela and Iran and we saw what happened.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And I think that that's part of the motivation, or if you will, behind this this standoff with Russia that's happening, because Eurasia is a huge is a region that's replete with not just natural resources that could act as collateral, but also the human capital. There a lot of people live in Eurasia, so they look at the human capital there as well as collateral. So I think that we have to understand that that's an aspect of it as well, and that motivates the geopolitical stance that Western Empire has been taking vis-a-vis Russia. And, you know, this has been laid out by people like Zbigniew Brzezinski long ago, that we need to control Ukraine because we need to control Eurasia, because that's where much, if not most, of the world's resources are concentrated, and we need to control that if we're going to sustain ourselves, if Western Empire is going to sustain itself. So, you know, we're seeing it happen in Ukraine vis-a-vis Russia, and we're seeing it play out in Syria as well. And what's happening is piracy. It's utterly criminal. And, you know, just the way that Syria has been subject to relentless attack over the past 11 years is just, it's so dispiriting to me every time I read about some new development. But in the last minute, 45 seconds, is there anything you'd like to impart or leave us off with, anything we should keep our eye on or anything of that sort?
Well, obviously, we're, you know, the elections here in Lebanon, may not be able to formulate a government. We may still be like in a caretaker government for another year. Last time, that's how long it took to form a government, actually a year and a half after the elections. Similarly, in Iraq, is still struggling to form a government since the election almost 3 months ago. And that's still up in the air. Yemen, all of these open wounds are going to have to come to a head in the next few weeks. So keep your eyes peeled here.
Absolutely. Laith, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me again. I always appreciate your insights, and I look forward to another conversation soon.
You have a great evening.
You too. Thank you.